For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to have giving the talk tonight Brian Taylor, who's our work leader here at Ancient Dragon Zengate. Brian, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Taigen, for the opportunity to speak. I'm going to talk about Sangha tonight, and I think we talk a lot about Sangha being both from the sort of the small circle, like this circle here, to vast, including so many beings, past, present, and future. And I'm mostly going to focus on the Sangha, the local Sangha, although I'll get into a little bit the broader circles as well. And the reason I want to talk about this is that this fall I received the Bodhisattva precepts, and a central part of that is the Triple Treasure, of course, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, Sangha being the community. Sangha has since then really been on my mind a lot. And I think it's because my feeling of connection here has been growing since I took the precepts. That actually was a part of that deeper connection, is making that commitment and living it out here in community. As I have, you know, worn this rakusu, which I sewed with others in a community setting over an 8-month period, getting together and doing that. As I've been a work leader, as friendships has developed and other things. I want to speak from a particular experience that I've had, and that is about community. And that is, for 32 years, I was immersed professionally in an Episcopal church parish and a diocese, which is a statewide area in the case where I was, of churches, and also in the national church. And so I had this sense for all those years of a local community, and a wider still one, and then, you know, worldwide Christianity and historic and all that. So I always felt that connection of community. And I learned a lot during those decades about what community can be at its best and its worst, what can be helpful and what can be harmful about it. And so as I talk about Sangha and community in our setting, I'll mostly touch on some of the things that I have experienced in community and what it is to take refuge in that, and especially how Sangha is of great benefit. And I use that word because I really like it. It's this word that really means making good. Bene and feet, or benefaction, or benefactor, is someone who makes good, literally. So there's so many ways in which I think Sangha makes good. And I want to talk about it on the levels of the individual experience, our experience as a group here, our experience of being in the world that is around us, and the Sangha's relationship with the world around us, and also briefly the Sangha's relationship with Buddhism in general.
And if I may, I neglected to mention in the introduction that Brian is also an Episcopal priest as well as a member of our Buddhist Sangha. And one of the treasures of this Sangha is that we have so many people with a range of different Buddhist and other spiritual backgrounds. Thank you.
Thank you. And in those 30 years, I've also been a part of other sanghas, Buddhist sanghas as well, practicing in other places. And so I've sort of witnessed community in both Buddhist and Christian settings for quite a while, although I have a lot more experience in the Christian setting. So just right up front, I want to say that what I have to say about community and the good that it makes in various ways is a large part of the reason why I support it financially with a monthly pledge. It's also why I say yes as often as I can to helping out to support this place by being work leader or other things that I do here occasionally. Is I want to support it because of it's making good all the time on a variety of levels, and by supporting it, I'm not only just, you know, practicing dana, giving, but I'm also supporting something that is very good in this world. Perhaps the most thought of or often thought of benefit or good making of Sangha is for the individual. You come here into this space, and I do, and right away in the foyer out here in the vestibule, you start encountering a rich living tradition, and it's all around you in resources. There's the Buddha in the vestibule, flyers about how you can get more deeply into this tradition. There's that wonderful saying on the Han that you can't miss when you walk by every time, life and death is the great matter, don't waste time. And that affects you. You walk into the Zendo, there are cushions here for you to sit on, and there's the altar and Buddhist images around, other people to sit with in this space. There's the teacher and various practice leaders that you can meet with individually if you make appointments with them. Even in the kitchen, there's this wonderful library where you can check out books on online resources. I mean, I listen to the talks that are posted online several times a week, and it's just an amazing audio library there. There are quiet days here, sessions, special events, and not to mention all of the bodhisattvas through the ages who are hovering around here supporting you on your cushion. And so for you, as soon as you walk in the door, there's all this encouragement for you as an individual who is seeking, you know, in the Soto Zen way. And it's just here for the taking, for you to settle into, kind of immerse yourself in this environment and let it affect you however it needs to affect you, and to take in whatever you can take in, and to be at home in it. In Christian communities, this aspect of community, I think, in my experience, is often overlooked. There is a similar richness. You know, there's stories, there's scripture, there's clergy who are there, you know, happy to make an appointment with you and talk to you about your faith tradition. There's libraries, there's outreach programs, there's retreats. And I often would ask myself, well, how many people are really taking advantage of these resources in order to really dig into this and go somewhere with it as they are able? And it's easy to you know, make assumptions about people, and I often was proven wrong. I underestimated people all the time. And yet, I really do think that it's a relatively small percentage, that most people in Christian communities, at least, are content to skim the surface, or they're there for other reasons. And I'm not in a position to judge that. They may be there for fellowship, or they may be there to just be in a community of people, and they're not really that interested in reading and practicing and studying and meditating and all those other things. There seems to be a much higher percentage in Buddhist sanghas that I've been a part of, including here, of people who want to take advantage of these rich resources that are here as individuals, and benefit from what this tradition and what this place offers all the time. I don't know if that's true, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is its ongoing availability to you as an individual. At any time, you can dig in and go deeper and connect with other people as you do that. The second purpose or benefit of Sangha, I think, is our benefit to one another. As I said, you can look at Sangha worldwide, historically, past, present, future, and I'm talking mostly here about our benefit to one another as dragons here in ancient dragons and Zengate. Taking refuge in Sangha, as well as Buddha and Dharma, is not just receiving, it's also giving of oneself in a community. It's a way of finding yourself at home in something, like finding yourself at home in Sangha so that you can give yourself to it. I mean, a home is not really a home if you're just taking from it, and so there's always that opportunity to give of yourself, first of all, just by being here, so that others might benefit from your presence as well. And some of the ways we give ourselves to community and Sangha are obvious, and we see it all the time. We help each other to learn how to sit, how to bow, how to do the rituals that we do here. There's Dharma discussion that we'll have in a moment where we can talk about what I'm saying here. There's informal conversation over tea afterwards. There's work together on Sundays and the session days. There's other activities that go on. There's a recovery group. There's a discussion group around Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the book. There's a practice commitment period at least once a year, if not twice. There's the opportunity to receive the Bodhisattva precepts, friendships that develop. I mean, there's so many ways in which we can connect with one another as community if we're looking for it, if we're open to it and interested in it. But there's something else, I think, about connecting in community as Sangha that is not so verbal, and that is, or not verbal at all, and that's just sitting together. The effect for me of having you sit next to me and you sit next to me is profound. It helps me remain upright and face into my life just by having companions to sit with. I had this image as we were sitting here earlier, almost as if, you know, when we're facing the wall, we've kind of got locked arms, you know? We're like locked arms together facing into life because we're really with each other as we sit in silence. Sometimes when I've had some difficult times in the last 2.5 years that I've been here, the most helpful thing is not just conversation, but having you sit next to me, really. And I'm especially aware of that on the sitting days and the sessions that I've attended. It's very intimate, and it's very connected. And we really feel that on Sesshin when over time, especially a few days, we get into this kind of rhythm together. And there's this sort of dance where we're attuned to each other physically. In our bowing, in our eating, in the chanting, in everything we do, it's almost as if we're just one body that is doing this as one together. In the Christian community, the place where I felt that most strongly, and I did frequently, was in the Mass or the Eucharist, which we, in the Episcopal Church, we did every Sunday. And I know that many other people did too. And that there was something about going up to the altar together, and especially during the communion service where people are receiving the bread and wine, where people were very vulnerable and very open, almost as if they were children again, and innocent, nonverbal. There's this carrying this knowledge that we are one body in Christ in the church setting, all silently receiving this same body as consecrated bread, very intimate and attuned, and the enormous support that many, many people in that setting find from just that simple action. But there's another form of interpersonal connection in Sangha and in community in general that seems to be much stronger in the Christian culture than it does seem to be in at least the Buddhist sanghas that I've been a part of. And I'm happy to be proven wrong about that because I don't have as much experience in Buddhist sanghas as Christian community. And that is what Christians would call pastoral care of one another. In most churches, this is fairly central. When a member is in trouble, when they're hurting, when they're sick, when there's a death in the family, all this stuff happens. I mean, people talk about it with one another. People talk to the person who's hurting. They are maybe invited out to lunch. Food is brought to their home by people So much so that you end up sometimes giving away the food that people are giving you because it's too much and it's going to spoil. Hospital rooms are visited. There's follow-up, checking in. And I know for a fact from people who have walked through in this way that there are many people who feel as if they never would have made it through some really hard times had it not been for this kind of care in community that would have been otherwise unbearable. I know that this is slowly developing more, as it seems to be, in Buddhist circles as Buddhism becomes more at home in the West. And I know that there are members of our Sangha, including Sarah and others, who are in a Master Divinity program or somewhere else where they're going through what's called clinical pastoral education, which is a supervised clinical experience with other students in usually a hospital setting. Where you learn about kind of pastoral skills, and those people may well exercise those skills professionally eventually in hospitals or prisons or hospices. But I hope that that kind of thing that is going on, that is growing, I think, in Buddhism and in this country at least, will also encourage the kind of compassionate care for one another in sanghas that I have seen so powerfully in church settings. The third function or purpose of sangha, the way it makes good, is how it contributes to the world around us. It's easy to underestimate that. Sometimes it's very obvious. You know, we keep the doors open, and seekers come in off the street. There's new people all the time. It's free of charge. They are welcomed warmly into our midst, and to find out if this is perhaps for them. Taigen makes witness as a teacher, and other members of the Sangha make witness as members of this Sangha and as Buddhists at demonstrations, at educational forums, outside of these walls. And people have an effect when they do those things. It is, I think, impossible in the short term to measure the impact of a community, a small community, on the wider community in which it sits, unless you look back on it over time and you get some hints of it. And even then, you don't know what kind of impact you're having. I watched this happen over 30 years in Albuquerque. I was in one place for 30 years, and we were very visible in the community in a couple of ways, one of which was that we were very strong advocates all those years for LGBT inclusion, rights, equality, and, you know, leadership in the community, things like that. And we took a lot of heat at times for that. And we became known in the city, even nationally within the Episcopal Church, for being a kind of a beacon of hope for people in that way. And I still hear from people who I never met who said you would never understand how powerful your church's presence was for me at this time in my life in New Mexico or whatever. But we were also a kind of a beacon for the inner life, because we focused a lot on spirituality in that community. And that was also very public. And the thing that I learned over time is that in a very subtle way, much less splashy than social issues, this has an effect over time as well on the community, the wider community in which a smaller community sits. Because I think one of the things it says to people, whether or not they ever come here, is this is possible in this life. There are people doing it. the way to live is not only what you see on television and what you read on the internet and in popular culture. That, everybody knows about that. We're inundated by it. There are other ways to live too, and one of them is the kind of quality of life that we nurture here. And the fact that this is happening here, whether or not other people in Chicago do it themselves, it's a huge benefit for them to at least know that it is available to them, that one can do this. And then they do sometimes. It's not, you know, because otherwise, if they don't see it and know it, that it's there in reality with these people on Irving Park Boulevard, it's in a movie, you know, it's in some cockamamie Tibetan monastery movie or something, you know, with Brad Pitt. And or it's in some book, you know, or some impossibly holy men's off somewhere. But it's not. It's here.
Hey, Brad does a lot of good work.
I know he does. It's true. It's true. So I saw the influence of a healthy and grounded and actively engaged practicing spiritual community, and it's no small thing. And I think whether or not we know it, we do that too. Lastly, I think as Sangha, we are contributing to the ongoing development of Buddhism historically. Keep in mind that Shunryu Suzuki and others came to this country in the 1950s and 1960s, partly, as my understanding, and I'm happy to be corrected later if this is not accurate, partly because in Japan, other than in monasteries and universities and for priests in training, there was little interest in Zazen. There was very little interest in developing communities of practice the way we have come to expect here in this country. In local Japanese temples, they were focused on other things. Life transition rituals and festivals and things like that. And they came to America, and once they were here, there was a unique development in Buddhist history, and that is they created communities of serious practice and learning with people in the workaday world who would come, as you do, to a place like this to study and to sit and do sesshin and then go back to your apartment, your job, your families, your friends. And there are people doing this in various cities all over the United States and Europe because of this vision. And it didn't exist here until teachers created it. And I'm not sure where else that kind of thing has existed in the history of Buddhism. I don't know. I mean, from what I can tell, an awful lot of the serious practice has gone on among monastics. And people in the world, maybe not so much. And now this is a norm for Buddhism, at least in this country. When you think of a Zen center, that's why people go, in large part. So we are part of an early generation that is carrying that development in Buddhism forward. And that's a big deal. I think that's a really big deal. And as we practice, therefore, we're practicing not just for ourselves, but also for the ongoing growth and evolution of Buddhism. So that's sort of a few things that I've experienced in community that I see some parallels to here, and would love to hear your thoughts on some of these things.
Thank you very much, Brian. Helpful talk. I just need to say something. We were talking about pastoral care.
Yeah.
And more I feel like a significant part of my time is given to that.
Mm.
To in various ways talking to people, actually sometimes individually in person, but often at a distance too. Actually, it would be great if that happened more
right.
In a Sangha way, too.
Right, exactly. The more that's shared, the more it becomes part of the culture.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah.
So questions, comments, responses for Brian, please.
I wonder, I'm going to maybe make a suggestion to target at the door, whoever the practice people or something, that maybe we need, as we have a work leader and a tenzo and a, other leaders in our sangha, that we have a pastoral care point person, that would be a leadership position. Because I think communication is an issue, and some things come to Tigan, and he can't tell everybody everything.
Yeah.
And so that might be a possible way to move us in that direction. I think everybody appreciates that as an important thing that I think we would all benefit from as a practitioner.
There are a lot of ways to do that. I mean, just one example, and it isn't necessarily a model that would fit here, is that we used to have a weekly meeting among clergy and lay pastors. And there were people who were identified and somewhat trained in lay pastoral care who were not ordained. And we would just talk about people in the community that we're experiencing various kinds of things that are going on, and trying to share information and ways in which might be helpful, and who talked to them last, and is there some way we can respond that we're not doing already, things like that. I wondered, Sarah, if on this issue you have any thoughts about it, being in a seminary setting and being around Buddhist and Christians on this.
Yeah.
And growing up in a Buddhist environment. I'm curious, Tigan, whether the last point I made about Zen temples in Japan, and also how perhaps this is a new development in terms of working with people to practice deeply in their workaday life in America. Is that a new thing in the development of Buddhism? Is that accurate to say that?
I think to the extent that it's a focus in American Buddhism, I think, is new. I think there have always been in Japan and China, I'm not sure, but probably in Korea and China, there have been lay people who've been actively engaged in practice. Mm-hmm. So it's not totally new. Mm-hmm. But I think the focus on actual active meditation practice by lay people, in the way that it's seen as the focus Americans at places, that's kind of new. That focus. Traditionally in Asian Buddhism, there was more of a devotional context. So lay people were drawn to temples, to Buddhist centers, and be actively engaged in devotional practice, but also to some extent in meditation. So it's not completely new, but the emphasis, I think, partly that's just the historical accident, maybe, of Suzuki Roshi and other Japanese and people coming to America in the 60s and the hippie movement, and people wanting to, being interested in developing consciousness and meditation, fitting into that.
Right.
And that's seen as, still, as what Buddhism has to offer, and it has been what Buddhism has had to offer to our culture. So I think, in that sense, it's a focus that's new.
Maybe the other side of that is what might develop in this country over time as Buddhism is more established through the years is more of what has been the case in Buddhist cultures in Asia. And I think of this because I just finished a book that was in our library here that I was mentioning to Sarah as I came in today called Silence and Noise, Growing Up Zen in America. And it's an interesting book. I can't remember the name of the guy. He's a young man in the who grew up as a child at Green Gulch.
I think it's probably Lou Richmond's son.
Okay. And what he talks about there is the difference between being interested in Zen as a new thing as an adult, as a convert, as if you will, and you know taking on a meditation practice intentionally. The difference between that and being a kid who grows up in a Buddhist family and seeing it as your religion. And one of the things that he points out about that is that there's much more, for him, a sense of the precepts and the life of the ethical life of being a Buddhist and the traditional teachings of being a Buddhist, which maybe has been under-emphasized for adult American convert Buddhists who are more interested in meditation. And maybe what needs to develop is more of the sense of this as a lifestyle and as the teachings, especially the precepts.
Chris, thank you for your talk. I've been thinking about the idea of Sangha a lot lately. And on a lighter note, I wanted to quote, ancient dragon fairy on Niyasan. Once, I think, Nation was talking, and he said something along the lines of people tend to think of the two jewels and the semi-precious stone, the Buddha, Dharma, and then the Sangha being semi-precious stone. And I thought it was very eloquently put when you said it like that. Because I've practiced at I've been to a couple of retreat centers and practiced with different people. The Sangha really for me is like the reality of the teachings and like the real potential for what humans can be and like what the world can be like. Because I think for whatever reason, sometimes there's a sentiment that we are just innately negative beings, that we have this like potential for anger and hatred and delusion, but I from practicing the Sangha and from Zazen and stuff, I tend to think that actually our potential is much more than that, and that just is some of the baggage left from other things. But I also like the point you said about growing up with precepts as an ethical way of life, because it is interesting that Westerners are primarily interested in meditation, and that the precepts are sort of an attack on for most people. But studying these things now and sort of learning the distinction between like Kai and Hinsu is really very interesting, and I think Zazen is pretty incomplete without the precepts and without the Sangha to keep you in check.
Thank you.
I just will say that one of the things that I have appreciated that has grounded me in Soto Zen, the whole practice life, though I've enjoyed practicing checking out other practices a little bit, but Soto emphasizes meditation, but also then the precept side of how we express meditative awareness in our everyday activity is a large emphasis all through Zen tradition. So, the point of the meditation is not just to get to some exalted state, but how do we express something in
for everyday activities. So, yeah, precepts are very important.
One of the things I like about the concept of the three jewels is that they're both really simple, and they are, you know. Buddha is Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, the Dharma is the teaching, so Buddhism, and Sangha is the people who practice Buddhism. But I love that there seems to always be a wink, you know, in it, that there's a door that you can kind of open with each of them. You know, like Buddha is Shakyamuni Buddha, but you know, what is it, Buddha? You know, and then Dharma is the teaching, but what isn't Dharma? Sangha is us right here, but who isn't in the Sangha?
Right.
We're, you know, and like, and kind of playing around with that, you know, through time is fun.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I really love taking communion, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's true. Well, yeah, I think in a spiritual community, whether or not someone wants to participate fully in what everybody else is doing is, you know, I mean, that's people come into communities with all sorts of things, and it's important to somehow create an atmosphere where that's really okay, and it's really okay to just show up here once in a great while, or to not know how to do things right, or you know, whatever it is, wherever you are, it's okay to be here, and we're just glad you're here. There's, you know, this thing that happens sometimes in, I don't know if it probably happens in Buddhist circles. I bet it does, because people are people. In Christian circles, you know, some people like to use guilt as a motivator, which never works, but, you know, they do it anyway. And, you know, they'll, like a clergy person, or even a lay person, will say to somebody who hasn't been in a while, "I haven't seen you in a while." You know, dot, dot, dot. Like, you're supposed to fill in the blank and feel terrible. And I bet it happens in some Buddhist communities, too.
If I ever say that, it's so great to see you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I said that yesterday.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Yeah.
It's good to see you too.
Well, it's good to be back on a Monday night. I've been doing mostly Sunday mornings, and it's good to be back here on Monday night. It's a different feeling, and you know.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah.